Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are keeping calm. We're staying local. Don Mohler joins us now live via satellite as we're doing all things from his palatial estate over in Catonsville, where he's ordering some state fair and waiting for Fadley's to get open out there. And, of course, supporting my friend, his son, Jeff Mohler, Mohler & Gary Realty as well. Don, you know, I tell you, sometimes in these pandemic times, I have these scheduling things, and we're usually out having chicken and waffles or having a crab cake down at Fadley's and doing stuff. I was going to book this next guest on all to myself because, you know, I used to be a sports radio station. I don't know if you heard that or not, Don. And I used to talk about sports around
here. Once upon a time, were there sports?
We used to have sports here like 3 weeks ago. And Ron Snyder has been a friend of mine for, by 25 years. I've lectured his classes. We were journalists together at one point. We're still journalism lovers. Don Mohler, who once told me I was going to be the Chris Thomas of Baltimore journalism back in 1982. And lo and behold, a book on the CFL Baltimore, don't call them Colts, Stallions. Ron, welcome into Baltimore Positive and WNST and the pandemic on the back end of Mohler apparently coming out and trying to teach those children of yours about ethics and stuff in journalism, right?
Two classes at Towson University, the best and the brightest, I'll tell you.
He did a great job coming out and really helped give the kids some great perspective on all things local journalism-wise.
Well, Don, I don't want to puff you up too much, but he asked me to come out a few years ago, and I thought it was fascinating that I could lecture a class about journalism and ethics. And this is before all that fake news got started with the orange guy. You know, this was like back when the world was normal and we still thought we had ethics in journalism. But Ron, you know, you've inked a book here, and you've done a couple books, and I told Don I had you on for wrestling last year in the wrestling book, and local wrestling legends, and you and I had a spirited conversation. One of the weird parts of the Stallions is I was on the radio during all that, and you know, I was young and rambunctious, and I wanted an NFL team, and I did go to some of the CFL games. I was in Vancouver for the Grey Cup with my dear friend Harvey Myers, formerly of the Emerald Tavern, now doing well in a semi-retirement. They put Harvey out the stud. And we were out in Vancouver for the Grey Cup, so I have some memories of it, but I was not a guy that was, like, out there covering the team, around the team all the time. I sort of thought it was a little weird, you know, when it was going on. I didn't fully embrace it like the Colts, and, you know, I'm not ashamed of that one way or another. I had guests on. I did my thing, but seeing sort of someone take that and clarify it, even for me, because I lived through it, but I couldn't write a book on it. So, I mean, I really tip my cap for you to go back and do this project, man.
Well, I think we have a little different perspectives on that time of Baltimore sports history. You know, you grew up with the Baltimore Colts. I was 6 years old, or not even 6 years old, when the Colts left just, 36 years ago this week.
Well, that changes things for you, Mohler, right? I mean, he didn't lose his dog in the 58 parade
man.
You did, right?
I want Ron to continue that story in the perspective because I remember, I mean, I was one of the guys that cried when the Mayflowers pulled away, so go ahead.
Well, we all have a different perspective on it, though. It is fascinating, right?
Right, and I was 18. I was a freshman in college when the Ravens arrived. So, literally, I went my whole childhood without an NFL team. I actually grew up a Dolphins fan because that was the games that we got every week, you know.
And your dad liked Shula, probably, right?
A little bit, yeah. he typically liked whatever one was better on the point spread, but no. no, I'm just kidding, Dad. You know, so then I went through the expansion process where we thought, well, we're going to get an expansion team, and you know, one went to Charlotte and kind of understood that one. You know, it was a new market, and then we thought, you know what, we're going to get that second team, and then it went to Jacksonville, and I was just like, you know, I just remember literally crying in the middle, you know, 14, 15 years old, crying, like, what do we got to do? And then, of course, you know, Paul Tagliabue tells us to go build a museum. And I'm like, you know what? I'm done with the NFL at this point.
Yeah, I was sitting at the front bar at Bohager's with a bottle of champagne on ice, ready to celebrate if we had gotten the team. You know what I mean? Like, I was ready for that. And I remember all the letdown of all that. I remember the Dolphins-Saints game, right? I mean, you were a Dolphins fan. That must have been a big night for you. I say that was the drunkest I ever saw any crowd anywhere I ever was, and I've been to 30 Preaknesses. But that was a wild memory for anybody that can put yourself into that time where Boogie Wineglass and the Bombers and, you know, the Glazers wanted a team. Baltimore was an epicenter for football, but it was left at the altar, literally.
Yeah, absolutely, multiple times. And of course, that doesn't even count the times that the Bucs teased about coming and the Cardinals teased about coming, and I think even the Rams and the Raiders at various points kind of teased a little bit. And, you know, then we said, you know what, we kind of reserved the fact that we kind of accepted the fact that we weren't going to get an NFL team. And then Jim Sparrows comes to town and sells us on this CFL team. And, you know, this was before the internet. So, I mean, all I knew about the CFL was, okay, Warren Moon played there for a little bit. You know, Doug Flutie was there, and I knew Pinball Clemens, and that was really about it. But, you know, I was like, they're here, they're in town, let's give it a shot. And I just remember it being fun football. It was, you know, blue collar guys. And it just told a great story. They came in, they won right away. They got to the Grey Cup in 94. They win it all in 95. And, you know, they're packing Memorial Stadium with 30,000, 40,000 fans a night. And then, you know, November 6, 1995 comes along. And, you know, Art Modell announces that the Ravens, the Browns are moving to Baltimore. And, you know, as soon as that announcement came by, you know, they played a couple more games, won the Grey Cup, and that was the last we ever heard of them. I mean, it was just... an unbelievable, everything you want in a sports story, this had.
Well, it had a beginning and an end, right? Run me through the day Jim Sparrow said the Baltimore Colts, or whatever they were going to be called, the Stallions at that point, because we were all yelling the CFLs is what they were called, literally, and they ran the horse around. I was out there for all that stuff. And this whole story is, 28 months, 30 months? I mean, literally... not a very long period of time. It's literally a snapshot.
I mean, February of 94 to basically January of 96. I mean, by the time they, the Grey Cup and they... wasn't even 2 years. But I mean, my book obviously goes into the whole loss of the Colts. You know, we had the USFL team there that 1 year, even though they trained in Philadelphia. They played in College Park and called themselves the Baltimore Stars. We didn't have football, and this was football. It wasn't an NFL, but it was neat. It was fun. And the fact that these guys won, and like you said, they called themselves the CFL Colts, and then the NFL sued them, and then they had to go that whole year just known as a team with no name. I mean, they were on ESPN, they were on Washington Post, New York Times. It was a national story, and this was the NFL sticking it to Baltimore again. If you remember, everyone was like, they're sticking, they take our team, we get a CFL team, and they won't even give us the dignity of allowing us to have a team with the Colts. They've stolen the Colts twice from us in many ways. So, I mean, this really had a little bit of everything, and it was a story I always wanted to tell. And I always felt like it was a unique time in Baltimore sports history. Remember, this was also 94, was also the year of the strike. So, you know, for a time there, the CFL team was the only game in town. And if you wanted to watch sports in Baltimore, like right now, we would love to have a CFL team, an arena team, you know, a Sandlot team. We'd love to have any team to root for right now playing organized sports.
Yeah, I'm
right
not a
now.
Big fan of the video games, Ron. Ron Snyder joining us here, local author, journalist, journalism teacher. He's done all sorts of things. Don Moeller also with us on Baltimore Positive. Don, this is where I want to bring you into this thing, because you are the sort of the elder statesman in this whole thing. I met you in 1982.
I seem to be the elder statesman wherever we go. Put it to you this way, the elder.
No. When Venatoulis is... Bring Venatoulis or Barbara Mikulski around, and we defer. You know what I mean? There are a few people older than you. We'll find Hutchinson at some point.
Hey,
some other
Dutch,
people.
Dutch is older than I am. There
okay, but so for you, you tell the story of 58 and losing your dog.
Right.
You have these memories of Johnny. You know, moved into adulthood and drank beer at Memorial Stadium and Burt Jones, and you get a teaching gig, and I meet you in 82. I literally remember being in your office the day the Colts left. The Colts left in March of 84. It was my junior year of high school. It was right around this time of the year, as we talked about last weekend. And, Ron, I've seen you sharing all these CFL videos and other things that are out there. Don, you had been through, and I had been through, because I worked at the paper in 84, you know, right around that period of time. I was at the News American, when the team left. I had been working there about 8 weeks at that time. And this was strangely 2 months, 3 months after the Orioles won the World Series. That was a period of time there when the Stars happened, and then the Cardinals were going to happen, but nothing happened. You were one of those guys. You had disposable income. You loved football. Your mom loved football. Your brother, everybody loved football. Do you have Stars memories at all? I mean, I would bring you in on this, because I was on the radio, but it wasn't. You know, I was an Oriole guy at that point, and I saw it as sort of minor league football that could be fun, you know? And I was a Skipjacks fan, so I don't even think about minor league. I didn't take it all that seriously in that way.
Well,
you know?
I'm going to turn that question a little bit, Nestor. I'm going to respond to it, because I said to both you and Ron off the air, I hadn't shared with you my reaction to this very minute. And when I was reading about Ron's book, and again, we're with Ron Snyder, the book is A Season to Forget, the story of the ninth. No, that's the other book. This one. That's the previous book. This one's on the Baltimore Stallions, and it is available on Amazon, wherever you get your books. When I was reading about the Stallions and its history, what I was struck by, Ron and Nestor, and again, you guys know I'm a sports nut. I love sports. It truly is. It's one of my guilty pleasures. It's the way I get away from everything, whether it's the Orioles, the Ravens, the NFL, you name it, lacrosse, little league, big league, all across. I love sports. And when I was reading about this team and this two-year period, I thought to myself, it's like a black hole. I don't remember anything about it, which tells me I wasn't engaged, and I can't for the life of me.
Well, you know, I would think this is a time where, like, Jeff was in high school, right? You were in Catonsville at that time. I mean, you had other things that were on your mind in 1994-95, right?
But why wouldn't I? Yeah, at that time in 94-95, I was actually the central Baltimore County Public Schools, the central office. I was the assistant superintendent for communications. I had just left Catonsville High School. But Ron, the question for you becomes, what kind of response did the team get, both in terms of media coverage and in fan support? Because my thought to myself, I really did think about getting ready for this interview. I'm thinking, I love sports. Now, why in the world wasn't I, and let me see, my son in 94, so my son would have been, 17 or 18. Why weren't we into this? So what kind of reception did they get in that two-year span?
Well, I mean, from an attendance-wise, I mean, there were over 30,000 fans a game there for most of the games. I think in 94 especially, there was more media coverage than they probably would have gotten otherwise, in part because of the national story involving the CFL Colts lawsuit and playing.
Well, it was a little bit of a circus, Ron. I mean, you were younger. I mean, when the people in the stands would yell Colts, you know, right. It wasn't Cunningham. Cunningham was doing the radio. I don't remember who the announcer was, but the announcer would say, "You're Baltimore CFL." And the crowd would yell Colts, just to want to yell Colts, because that's how good it felt to yell Colts in 1994, Don. And I'm sure you can, you get a little bit of feeling of that. But I remember the players in O.J. Brigance, sort of famously, Shar Pradanish and Pringle. But the game was weird, right? I mean, Ron, the wider field, the rouges, there was something to learn involved
right.
in the CFL.
There was a learning curve, but it was wide open football, and I don't think if the team wasn't any good, I don't think people would have that fond of memory of it, because a lot of those U.S. teams in the CFL were not very good. But this team was built with CFL players in mind. And for someone my age who had never had a football team, you know, didn't grow up, who knew Johnny Unitas was, obviously, who knew who Burt Jones was, but, you know, whose only memory was of the NFL in town was the Mayflower trucks. You know, it was nice to have a team to call your own. It kind of taught, it's a weird to think, but it taught you how to be a football fan. You know, Towson football was just getting kind of back. You know, Maryland football was obsolete at that point. Navy was in a down period. You know, so there was
baseball just going on strike.
Yeah, I mean, baseball going on strike. So this was the game in town. I mean, and it was just fun. I mean, it was on Channel 2. It was on the radio. The ESPN2 had games, and you know, it allowed you to kind of learn how to be a football fan. And again, they won. So you know, if they hadn't won, I don't think they would have been in. You know, the combination of them winning and the whole battle with the CFL Colts. You know, the tradition that was here, you know, I think the two groups of fans that were involved with supporting them was a lot of the former Colts fans that were fed up with the NFL after expansion and losing the Colts. And there were young fans like myself who just wanted a team to call their own. And then, of course, like you said, I mean, the NFL came in 95, you know, announced they were coming in 95. And I always make the analogy like, it was like, you know, Baltimore had been cheated on by a girlfriend, and you know they found a girl that was nice to them and did everything that they wanted. They wanted in a girl, and then when the girl came apologizing and promised they would treat them differently, they said, you know what, we're going to give you another chance. And then of course, you know, look, I'm a Ravens fan. The Ravens have been awesome. You know, they've been everything you could hope for: two Super Bowl championships, playoff contenders every year, always in the community. This is, you know, the support of the Stallions and wanting to do this book has nothing to do with obviously with not being a Ravens fan, not being glad that the NFL is here, but it was just a chance to kind of remember that unique time in Baltimore sports history, which I don't think would have worked in any other time in Baltimore sports history. I don't think, anyway, it had to be a perfect confluence of events, you know, the losing the Colts, losing out on expansion, having them being named the CFL Colts, and a baseball strike. So, I mean, would it have worked in any other time? No. And again, people can make the argument whether the support that they got here in Baltimore led to the Ravens. And, you know, I think it was a small factor. I think there were so many other factors that led them to come here. But, I mean, you can't deny that the fact that people saw that they could pack 40,000 fans in the Memorial Stadium for a CFL game showed that they could definitely support an NFL team.
That's a really great point. Those of you tuning in, we're with Ron Snyder, a longtime journalist, professor at Towson University, and author of The Baltimore Stallions, available all bookstores, out on Amazon, wherever you get your books. Ron, every story, and you talk about what made this the perfect time for this story. Every story has characters. You know, if you're going to make a movie, there are characters who come to the forefront. Who are the key characters in the Baltimore Stallions story?
Well, I think it starts with Jim Spiros, the owner. You know, he came into town, you know, a ball of fire. He came in at just the right time, kind of knew, picked his spot, and promised, you know, a winner, and came in and said, we're going to call ourselves the CFL Colts. And, you know, I think it started with him. Obviously, they had the connection to the old Colts. Tom Maddie was a part owner of that team. And he brought in, you know, a lot of the old Colts that backed them. I mean, they had it wasn't unusual for Johnny Unitas and Lenny Moore and Art Donovan to be, you know, on the sidelines of those games. And then, of course, the players. You know, some of the guys. If you talk to anyone my age, you know, they can reel off the names of that team as well as they could, you know, the Ravens Super Bowl team. Guys like Mike Pringle, Tracy Ham, the quarterback. Chris Armstrong, who's a high school football coach, one of their wide receivers here. Josh Miller, the punter, who went on to win a Super Bowl in the NFL. Of course, O.J. Brigance, you know, who everyone knows, obviously, through his battles with ALS and his time with the Ravens. But, you know, O.J. Brigance is the only player in pro football history to win a Grey Cup ring and a Super Bowl ring for teams in the same city.
Ron Snyder is here, and we're going to get to journalism and ethics and all that cool stuff. He's written a book. I want everybody to go out and take a look at the brief, brilliant history of the CFL champion franchise, the Baltimore Stags. You can grab the book, add on Amazon, Kindle it down. We got time on our hands. We have no baseball, no lacrosse, no basketball, no hockey, no horse racing. We got nothing going on right now except a little bit of storytelling. Last thing for you, Don Matthews was quite the character. And Jim Spiros would come around and do the show every now and again. And again, I was a brand new radio show. I had a ponytail. I was on AM radio. They only existed for the better part of 2 years, and Art Modell pulled into the parking lot. But I'll tell you, man, I went to that Grey Cup in Vancouver, and going from hotel to hotel in downtown Vancouver in November, Thanksgiving weekend of 1994, and seeing the fans of the Edmonton Eskimos take over this hotel, and the fans of the BC Lions who were in the game take over that hotel, and the Hamilton Tiger Cats, and the Toronto Argonauts, and the old Montreal Alouettes fans, and we broke their hearts, and you know, all the fans that gathered and collected the pins, and it was so right. Canadian. It was so. It was such a cool experience. I went back to Vancouver. I've been to Vancouver twice in 07 and again, I think, in 17. So I've been to Vancouver two other times. It was such a small town then, and that dome was the biggest thing going on. And they loved the CFL there. And I remember Tom Cochran of Red Rider played halftime, played Life is a Highway. And the stadium was full. And it was next time I went there, I saw you too 20 years later. But, you know, the CFL was one of those things that always had a little bit of traction, and beyond the story of the Stallions at that time was what Vince McMahon has tried to do twice, what the USFL tried to do, which was, oh, the NFL, you want to give the middle finger to Birmingham and Sacramento and Baltimore and San Antonio and Orlando, we'll put a league down there that combines America and Canada. There was a real thought at that time that this could have been a really comfortable number two league where it may have caught on in America in the way, let's say, you're a wrestling fan, that the other wrestling promotions can catch on, like a TNT or Ring of Honor, whatever it would be, that it could be profitable and long-standing. And the CFL is still the CFL. It's still very much a minor league to some degree. But at that point, it had a puncher's chance of not competing with the NFL, but being a more American entity. And the Stallions and Jim Spiros, that's really what he was betting on. He was betting on it becoming an AFL, a real thing that went on in America.
Right. And you know, look, you pointed out all of the graveyards of expelled U.S. expansion of professional football leagues. And you know, that gets into why doesn't that ever work? Well, there's a couple reasons. One, with the you know, is finding the right owners, right? There were, other than Jim Spiros and maybe the owner in Memphis, there wasn't a whole lot of quality owners.
Didn't Vegas have a bandit team for 10
Vegas
minutes?
Vegas had one for a season. And second off,
man, it's got to be funny to get my Burt Reynolds laugh. I got to be honest with you, Ron.
and then second of all, you know, they've always tried to pick cities where high school or college is really the king. You know, it's never worked in, you know, they've tried it in Birmingham a bunch of times. They've tried it in Memphis a bunch of times. And, you know, you can't really do it in the summer in some of those places because it gets really hot. And then you get into the fall season, and then, you know, unless it's the NFL.
It's Bama.
You know, it's Alabama football. It's Tennessee football. It's high school football. You know, those are always going to be king in those areas. And, you know, and then also, I think there's only so much sports dollar to go around. I mean, look at the XFL was obviously didn't get a chance to succeed as much as they would hoped in that first season this year because of the coronavirus epidemic. But, you know, they were happy with 15, 20,000 fans, and the Stallions had 30,000 fans. So, I mean, it's tough to get it to work, but it's worked in Canada because Canadians accept ownership of the league. For CFL fans, you know, Canada is theirs. I mean, and one of the things that I learned when writing this book that I didn't realize as a youngster watching it was just how upset a lot of Canadian fans were with the fact of an American team winning possibly and then eventually winning the Grey Cup. And I always said, well, what about when Toronto won the World Series? You know, so that was my argument.
Well, we should build a wall. You know, it couldn't happen now because we built a wall. What can
that would keep the virus
I'm
out too, Don.
Hey, Ryan, there are probably folks listening, again, more with Ron Snyder. Pick up his book on the Baltimore Stallions out there at Amazon, wherever you get your books. It's a great read. Ron, for folks who are listening, and you said the owner, Jim Spiros, was one of the key characters. He would be the leading man in the movie. Tell folks a little bit about who Jim Spiros was, how he got to where he was, where he came from. Give them some background on Spiros.
Well, Jim was a college football player. He played at Clemson. I had a little bit of time. He tried to make it in the NFL and CFL. Became a trainer, won a Super Bowl ring with the Redskins, I believe, was part of their training staff. Got into business, got into real estate, was a successful business owner, and came around and saw this U.S. expansion of the CFL, and him along with investors got involved in this endeavor. Plop, put his money where his mouth was. He put a lot of money into it along with other investors, and I think one of the things they didn't realize going in was just how much work Memorial Stadium needed at that point. I mean, in 94, the Orioles had only been gone for 3 years, but it was apparently in complete disarray. The plumbing was bad. They begged, bartered, and did everything they could to get that stadium up and going. I mean, they traded advertising, sponsorships for paint, to get the plumbing fixed, to get the seats fixed, because it was a mess. Again, it was an expensive endeavor. They were the only successful U.S. team, but I think once they realized they couldn't make it in Baltimore, the CFL team realized that they weren't going to make it in the U.S. They couldn't make it in Baltimore, they weren't going to make it anywhere, and they were the only team to kind of still move on. All the other teams were folded, and then the Stallions were technically folded, but then they became the Montreal Alouettes and became a really successful franchise for a long time. Spiros owned the team for about another year before selling it, and then went in and became a successful businessman in other endeavors, including real estate and restaurants. They had a reunion about 5 years ago here in Towson where they had a bunch of players get together to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Grey Cup. This is the 25th year anniversary this year. And, he's always said that everything he's accomplished in his professional career, the thing that he's most proud of is that 2 years with the Baltimore Stallions. And the funny thing is that everyone I talked to that was associated with that team, from Mike Gavigan, who's the PR director, is now Towson University, to players like Josh Miller, who won a Super Bowl ring with the Patriots, to O.J. Brigant, to Tracy Hammond, Mike Pringle. Every player I talk to, whether they went on the NFL or not, or had success in business, will tell you that some of the most enjoyable years of their careers was those 2 years in Baltimore, just because of the ride that they went on.
Ron Snyder joining us here in the book on the CFL Stallions. Don't call them the Colts. You can find him over Towson doing professorial work. And Ron, I tell you, man, for a guy to teach ethics and journalism, to associate yourself with guys like Mueller and I tell you what, man, your students have been well fed from us to come out there and speak about this. But this is this has been a wild little adjustment for the entire country, for business, for the economy, for what is truth, for 6 feet away in the Rose Garden with fake reporters asking fake questions and real reporters getting smacked around by a guy who has real ethical problems, I think, if we've been paying attention, Ron.
Well, I'm not going to get into politics today, but I will tell you that it's important out there, whether, in this day and age, just to make sure. I always tell my students, and I tell anyone that'll listen, when you're gathering information, especially when you're dealing with life and death like we are, make sure that you're looking to quality sources. Know who are the trustworthy news sources, and make sure that you are basing your decisions on the facts, whether they be scientific, historic, or what have you, because the only way you can make an educated decision about what's going on moving forward is to have the facts, and that's getting it from trusted sources, and I'll leave it at that.
I think the Russians have done a great job, and I saw a website two nights ago. Somebody shared a website, and I looked at it, and I said, that doesn't look right, and I resourced it and went back, and it's who owns it? Oh, I don't know. About, oh, look over there. You know, it really is amazing on the web how deceptive what is real and what is not can be.
I think it's very, Nestor, I think that's a terrific point. And again, I don't think there's anything political in that. I think that it one of the real challenges, and you guys now have decades of experience in journalism, one of the real challenges for our citizenry is the ability to try to discern what's real and what is not real. And in many ways, I think that's really going to be the key to the future of our republic, because it is so easy to manipulate facts. And I will say, and I'm not a guy that typically says on both sides, you know, I hate that. But in this case, I think there are advocates for positions all over the place that really have gotten, as you point out, Nestor, very, very good at putting out false information and making it look real. And I think it's something that we've got to be very careful of. Ron, before we let you get away, you've written books, Nestor's written books, you both have gone through the process. I think folks out there who are listening, particularly young folks who have an interest in journalism, have an interest in writing, either fiction or nonfiction, they'd be curious about your process. When you begin a book, walk us through beginning Soup to Nuts, how you get from the beginning of the idea to where the book is ready to publish.
Well, like I said, thanks. You mentioned earlier, this is my third book, the Stallions book. I also have, if you're looking for a baseball book, like you alluded to before, Season to Forget, the story of the 1988 Baltimore Orioles is also out there on Amazon and in bookstores. So if you're looking for a great baseball story that goes into 88-89 seasons, that's a great read as well. But what I look for first is a good story, something unique. Like when I wrote the book on the 88 Orioles, I said anyone can write a story about the World Series champions. What's it like to write a story about a team that lost 21 games in a row?
And then came back to a packed stadium, right?
Yeah, exactly. A fantastic fan night. 50,000 fans show up after the team went 1-23 to start the season.
I still have my ticket stub that night.
Look for a good story. And, I write mainly nonfiction. So, I kind of look to see, once I had that idea, I kind of just flesh it out a little bit. And then I kind of just reach out to some folks that may be associated with that story to kind of say, hey, would you be interested in supporting this endeavor as far as, interviews and research and things like that, just to see how that would go. I'll get into the research. I'll write a little bit of it, and then I'll start reaching out to publishers. Some of the guys, the bigger guys, like the John Eisenbergs and the John Feinstein's of the world, they work with agents, and they're doing an amazing job with some great stories. And that's the way, you can go as well. This is more of a side thing for me. It's more of just to keep my creative juices flowing. Years of being a newspaper reporter, you were always limited. I always loved the freedom you have of writing a book. You can just tell everything. You're not limited by a deadline or copy inches or what have you. And once you get a publisher to sign on, then you do the research. You do lots of research, lots and lots and lots of research, lots of interviews, and then lots of writing. And then it's a lot of fact checking and working with people to kind of edit it over and over and over again, because it's not like copy editing a 300-word story. It's copy editing a 75,000-page book. And it's a lot of tedious work, but it's to me it's relaxing. It's a way to be creative. With the Stallions book was the first book because I really wanted this story to be told. I wrote it without having a way to publish it. Was I going to self-publish it? Was I going to find a publisher to do it? Was I going to put it online? I wasn't sure. But luckily I found a publisher in McFarland Publishing to publish this book. And because I believed in the story. So the idea is to believe in what you're writing in, be passionate. I use the analogy very similar to, someone, whether it's looking for a job or looking, trying to move up in life, you're going to deal with some rejection. For every book I've gotten published or every idea I've gotten, book I've made it to print, I've had 5 ideas that have been knocked down. So it's a tough way to, it's tough. But you just got to be consistent. You have to be determined, and eventually it'll come around. All you got to do is get one person to say yes, and even if you wanted to, there are other ways out there, whether it be online or self-publishing, if you want to go that route as well. But be passionate about what you're writing about, and be determined, and it'll come around.
Once you come up with the idea, Ryan, and you go that you've got the enthusiasm, then is your process, do you set aside a part of the time every day to write, or do you write when you get time? How do you discipline yourself to keep that chapter one becomes chapter two, becomes chapter three, and that's your duty time then as well, because you've got this as well?
Well, I think everyone's a little unique. I mean, for me, again, because it's not my full-time job, it's where, I have time. I'll block off some time. I'll 30 minutes here, 2 hours there. Just finding that time to do it. Others, again, when you are doing this for a living as a primary job, you're going to have a big enough advance that you're going to be able to block off long portions of the day. For me, it was just a little bit here, a little bit there, and just trying to balance time management with job and family responsibilities until it got done.
I'm a method actor, Moeller. I got to sit and work it out. I mean, I got to sit down and do it. I can't do anything else. If I start putting a book down, it takes me an hour to get back to where I was when I sit back down the next time. I tried that. I can't write books that way. I can write short stories that way. I can't write a book that way.
So you just go after it.
I find that I have to go full Jack Torrance. Yes, I have to sit in a room and be an introvert for a long period of time and interact with nothing but the book. Anything else becomes a distraction. It's a distraction, just like Jack Nicholson. So I couldn't do it. Ron, I tip my cap to you for continuing to find these incredible sports stories to tell, whether it's a local wrestling book or whether it's the 88 Orioles. This time, Stas, dare I ask, what is next?
Well, right now, I'm just trying to get through the coronavirus pandemic.
like all the rest of us.
With the book that just came out, I mean, I've got some ideas in mind, but... I'm looking for some good ideas, and it will come around. I mean, I've put out 3 books in 4 years, so, I'm going to look for the idea, but I'm going to take my time for the next one.
Ron, take care of yourself. It's great to have you on. Appreciate you always having Don or I out to talk about ethics and journalism, two of my favorite subjects, although it used to be a bigger circle, where they resided. I do worry about all of us and the closure of Sports Illustrated and the downsizing and the coronavirus. I hope we still have journalism. We need it, right?
Well, I can tell you, look, I was at the Baltimore Examiner in 2009 when it closed, and a lot of it was from this last recession, and those jobs never returned to the newspaper industry. I know several reporters, I remember back at the Sun, who were let go at that time were actually out in the field when they found out they were losing their jobs, and I am concerned about, where this economic downturn will lead, especially the print journalism area. But, again... the thirst for information has never been greater out there. People want information. We're a country that evolves and continues to evolve, and hopefully we'll continue to find a way to put out good journalism.
Appreciate you, Ron. Take care of yourself. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County executive, joining us here on Baltimore Positive. Make sure you're getting out the State Fair and supporting our dear friends. Get some carry out, get some curbside from Evan Brown. Get the chicken and waffles, the shrimp and grits. That'll carry real well. You bring that home, some salads, whatever you need. Safely out to Catonsville if you're on your endeavors for essential needs. I consider chicken and waffles essential for me. State Fair in Catonsville. Also, our friends in Faithleys, they're coming to Catonsville next year. They're getting through this coronavirus. Well, Lexington Market has been closed down physically. You can still order the crab cakes online, have them shipped. They're delicious. They make a great gift. People will love you for it. And don't forget our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty. And of course, Don Moeller will be here all week long. We're doing more Baltimore Positive segments than we usually do. We're trying to put together some of the pieces of all the things we were doing for the election. If you missed Mary Miller last week, if you missed Sheila Dixon, if you missed T.J. Smith, if you missed Aru Vignaraja, all that up in our repository at Baltimore Positive. Don and I are yelling about all things coronavirus and the pandemic and the shutdown as well at Baltimore Positive. Many more guests ahead. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Keeping calm, staying local, and always staying Baltimore Positive.